Ms. Pollock, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mala Pollock, appearing pro se. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The facts of this case are very simple. I applied for two jobs as an attorney in the D.C. office of the Administrative Office of the United States Court System, your support service, the AOC. I was rejected for two of these positions on the sole grounds, that I would have to move from Kentucky to D.C. to take the jobs. I attempted to use their administrative process and was told that there was no administrative process whatsoever available for this type of claim. I then filed suit in the district court, federal district court for this district, and without citing any of Your Honor's contrary precedents, the district court dismissed the suit on the sole grounds of sovereign immunity. I'd like to move directly to the interesting part of this case, which is the merits. For over 200 years...
Would it make some sense to start with the ground on which you lost in the district court?
Well, to tell you the truth...
That is, after all, a threshold.
Yes, Your Honor.
Unless you show the district court was wrong, that would be fatal. I'm not saying it wasn't wrong. But.
Well, Your Honor, I've cited in my brief and discussed at length how this panel could not affirm the court on that basis unless it were to overrule cases from this circuit. And since the appellee has not asked you to overrule any cases from this circuit, it seems to me to be a non-issue. I mean, there are two bases for sovereign immunity here. Neither one of them works. Section 702, 5 U.S.C. 702. But this court already held quite some time ago that the waiver in 702 included the AOC, and nothing has changed since then. Then there's the Larson case, which was the only thing that the trial court discussed. It didn't even bother mentioning 702, though I argued in my briefs. And what the court said, the lower court said, without citing any circuit whatsoever, is that the Larson case did not reach constitutional issues. It was only available if an official had violated a statute, which seems an odd inversion of the pecking order of legal rules.
Regardless of what circuits have said,
yes,
you have Larson itself on your side?
Yes, Larson is myself on its side, but I don't claim that I have the authority, when the circuit has spoken, to rely directly on Supreme Court case law, though I can try. But even without that, this circuit said in Clark versus Library of Congress that Larson reached that far. And if the circuit were to change its mind, it would set up a circuit split with the 1st, 2nd, 10th, and 11th circuits. There are no circuits on the other side that I've been able to find. And oddly, the trial court decided this without citing any circuit precedent, or for that matter, without acknowledging the contrary Webster case from the U.S. Supreme Court, which the U.S. Supreme Court has since reiterated just at the end of last term in the Elgin case, that unless there's a very clear statement by Congress, an extraordinary clear statement by Congress, considered what wasn't clear enough in Webster itself, a claim for merely equitable relief, which is all I've asked for, on a constitutional violation must be allowed to reach the merits in an Article III court. I mean, as I perhaps impolitely stated of the AOC's brief, it takes this court's chutzpah jurisprudence to new heights, stating things like the AOC is not within 702 and citing for its sole support a case that had nothing to do with the AOC that said the Librarian of Congress was not within 802, which may or may not be a good idea, but it has nothing to do with the AOC. Which is why I think that the only interesting part is the merits of this case. I mean,
District Court didn't reach the merits, right?
No. No court has reached the merits.
Normally, if we thought you were right on sovereign immunity, we would send it back for the district court.
Yes, Your Honor, but this is a solely legal issue which was briefed to the court below. The court below chose not to rule on it. And what I think is going to happen, to be truthful, Your Honors, is that if you don't reach the merits, the court will merely rule against me on the basis of the merits, and you'll get it again, and it will have been delayed another 2 years.
Since she didn't address the merits, why do you think that?
Because even in the face of binding case law, to the contrary, which I cited clearly and discussed in my brief, the court did not deign to discuss that case law and ruled against me. I don't understand that opinion.
There is a discussion of Larson in the district court's opinion.
Yes. There is no discussion, however, of 702, and there is no discussion of the contrary case law about Larson that I cited.
Yes, I take it that in reading footnote 11 in Larson, you believe your claim is solidly on the side of the line drawn there that allows your suit to go forward.
Yes, I think that my suit should go forward. And I think that what's interesting about
because
this...
Because the relief you're asking is simply that the conduct you complain of cease.
Exactly. I'm only asking, this is not a case where I'm asking for damages, therefore I do not need any special waiver from Congress.
Well, there's another possible limitation indicated in that footnote. But if all you're asking for is the cessation of particular conduct, you do seem to fit on the right side of footnote 11.
That's all I'm asking for, Your Honor. I'm asking for something that no other entity in the federal government seems to have a habit of doing. Discriminating against job applicants merely because they would have to move to D.C. from one of the states. And as I've shown in my briefs, this was a specific problem addressed during the ratification debates. One of the things the anti-federalists argued was that if you set up this 10-mile square, the federal enclave that became the District of Columbia, the people who live there will use their proximity to elected officials to gain for themselves, and I love the word, exclusive emoluments, to the harm of the rest of the country. And they will get this self-satisfied, we are more important mindset, which I think is what people mean today when they say something like the within the Beltway mindset. Obviously, there's no flood of litigation problem here. There's no slippery slope problem here. Whatever the limits of the rights of a citizen as opposed to the federal government for interstate travel for the purposes of relocation and obtaining a job, my claim to come here to the Capitol to work for the government is right at its core. It's something that's so obvious that the Supreme Court in Crandall versus Nevada back in 1867, I think it was, rather than deciding what was then considered to be a difficult issue about the interaction of state and federal taxing authorities, said, well, we don't have to go there no matter what the litigants say. It's obvious from the structure of the government created by the Constitution that the federal government has the right to call citizens from any state to the federal capital to work for it and to do anything else for it. And therefore, correlatively, which is the beautiful word that this U.S. Supreme Court used, the citizen has the right to come to the capital to deal with the federal government, including to work for it. And no less a personage than James Yardell, who became one of the first associate justices of the Supreme Court, said during the ratification debate that the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, and I apologize, it was a typo in my brief, I think it said Article 1 at one point, of Article 4 is binding on the federal government and prevents it from passing legislation that would give, and his example was, a benefit to New England shipping that it didn't give to Southern shipping because the federal government can't act that way. So we have early precedent for my right. We have the fact that no agency of the government seems to have any need to violate it. And I think if you look at the, I think, rather muddy argument that the AOC makes on the merits at page, I think it's 45 of their brief, they've basically conceded everything I need to win on the law. They've conceded that...
Is your argument specifically about wanting to work at the seat of the federal government? What if the federal agency had an office in Chicago. Could they?
Well, the simple fact is, Your Honor, I think the right would govern there too, but you don't have to decide this to decide my case. This is the most beautiful starting case for a common law court. It's the tiniest, tiniest step. It's something that the Supreme Court made clear it thought was obvious over 100 years ago. As I said, whatever the limits of the right may be, my case is one where the right must exist if there's any right at all. May I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honors?
All right.
Thank you very much for your patience.
Mr. Interante?
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, John Interante and Ms. Pollack, John Interante for the administrative office. The court should affirm the district court's dismissal of Ms. Pollack's claim for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. The first reason is that the appellant's constitutional right to travel claim is not subject to judicial review. Congress specifically decided that it was unnecessary to provide such review to applicants.
You're not relying on the ground on which the district court relied.
Well, Your Honor,
jettisoning that.
Are you giving up the sovereign immunity argument completely? That's the question.
We're not giving up the sovereign immunity argument because our first argument is that if Congress did not provide for judicial review.
Different question. Let's go directly to the Larson question. Do you agree that the district court was simply wrong in holding that there's sovereign immunity from an injunctive action for constitutional violation? Do you agree with that or don't you agree with that?
Our argument first, do we agree with that there's a waiver for sovereign?
About 702, just on the sovereign immunity question. There are two arguments about sovereign immunity, one 702,
right,
and one that without 702, there's no waiver. So assume that you're right about 702. 702 is not a waiver.
Correct.
Can the, in light of Larson, isn't it the case that nonetheless there can be a suit for a violation of a constitutional right?
There may be, but not in this case.
Well, that's not what the district court held. The district court held there's never, right?
The district court held that there noted that there must be some legally recognized right, and consistent with Larson, there's no allegation here that, or the court did not find on the facts alleged in the complaint, that there was sufficient evidence that the administrative office acted unconstitutionally.
The court didn't purport to resolve the merits, which would have been crazy after having said that the suit was barred.
It did.
We seemed to jump to the merits. I mean, first you had a preclusion argument, then we tried to get back to Larson. You now jump to the merits.
Well, in response to Judge Garland's question, the court noted that Larson did not extend to that. Under Larson, the administrative office acted consistent with its regulations on merit recruitment plan, and it acted.
That has nothing to do with the constitutional claim under Larson.
But the only claim in this case is a claim that arose under the Court Personnel Act in implementing a merit recruitment.
Well, the claim arises under the Constitution of the United States.
But the actions underlying the claim are actions that the administrative office took consistent with its.
When was the CPA passed?
1990.
All right. Imagine that before, what happened before 1990? What would you say the rule was then?
Well, before 1990, some of the administrative office employees were subject to the Civil Service Reform Act. And that's part of the reason why, it's that's the primary reason why it was amended.
So during that period, if the AO announced we're just not hiring any black people, that's our rule, your view is that there was no waiver of sovereign immunity for that?
Well, Your Honor, the Administrative Office Personnel Act specifically provides for discrimination.
But it didn't. What if it didn't? What if it didn't?
If it didn't, then, well, first of all, there'd be a legally recognized or colorable constitutional claim.
Well, now you're getting to the merits, which is part of the question that Judge Williams was asking you about. Before we get to the merits, we need to know whether there's a waiver, whether the their sovereign immunity protects the United States against suits for violation of constitutional rights.
When the actions challenged arise under the Court Personnel Act and they're consistent with those acts, there's not a waiver of sovereign immunity. There is the possibility.
I see that in Larson. I just have nothing to do with Larson, which is the ground on which you won in the district court.
Well, in Larson,
Larson seems to say that sovereign immunity is not an obstacle to a claim, to essentially a claim against the federal government under the Constitution. Then it's slightly qualified by footnote 11, but otherwise, that seems to be the broad statement.
Well, the court did note that, you know, did not find, although she didn't go into great detail, that there was any sufficient allegations of a violation of a legally recognized right, which we would see.
What is that? I mean, one reading of that is that despite having found the jurisdictional bar, she leapt onto the district court, leapt into the merits, but that makes no sense. So short of that, what meaning are you assigning to that?
Well, I think the court was very careful to trace the claims and the allegations under the Court Personnel Act, and that she found...
How does that bear on Larson?
Well, the court latched onto the exception is if a federal official is acting as an individual and not within their recognized authority, established statutory authority, then Larson might not protect that action, but she did not find that the facts gave rise to that exception. So you're right. The court did find that Larson does not waive sovereign immunity in this case.
So then it's up to you to defend that outcome on the basis of Larson. And I've heard lots of things from you, but not that.
Well, under Larson, again, Your Honor, that Larson does not give rise to a waiver of sovereign immunity in a case where there is not a...
It doesn't talk the language of waiver at all.
Well, it does not allow injunctive...
The premise is that a waiver is unneeded.
Well, if we skip from Larson to our own opinions...
Very well, Your Honor.
Swan says sovereign immunity does not apply as a bar to suits alleging that an officer's actions were unconstitutional or beyond statutory authority. That's it. Plain. Clark, this circuit said, it is well established sovereign immunity does not bar suits for specific relief against government officials where the challenged actions of the officials are alleged to be unconstitutional or beyond statutory authority. That's exactly what she alleged here, that it was unconstitutional.
But, Your Honor, that's why we trace through. And the judge didn't cite the Second Circuit Dotson decision on the Court Personnel
Dotson
Act.
Dotson is not about sovereign immunity. Dotson is about CSRA. We'll talk about that in a moment. That's your fallback position.
Actually, Dotson does have a page on interpretation of Larson, and it comes out against you.
Right. So the only Dotson may help you on your second claim that the CSRA and CPA preclude the claim, but I think what Judge Williams and I are asking you is, don't you want to give up the argument that sovereign immunity protects?
Well, I think, Your Honor, we do think that the fallback argument under the Court Personnel Act not providing judicial review is a sovereign immunity argument to the extent that Congress did not consent to a suit against the administrative office arising from personnel actions taken under the...
Why you frame it in terms of consent to suit? I can see how you can argue from the statute that it had the effect of barring a suit, but it isn't a question of consent if the appellant is right on Larson.
Well, Your Honor, given the court's questions, we'll back off of Larson at this point and get to what we think is the compelling reason why the court did not have there is not judicial review for this particular claim. And the Civil Service Reform Act cases establish that that is your exclusive remedy. And it's a comprehensive remedial scheme, and if there are constitutional claims to be brought under the Civil Service Reform Act, you have to bring them through the established judicial review
process.
Well,
your claim is that the CSRA precludes federal employees from seeking equitable relief against agencies for unconstitutional action unless it provides specifically for it, right?
Well, this and this is not the Civil Service Reform Act. It's
no,
a parallel.
Based on a similar.
Correct.
And your best case is?
Well, our best case would be we look at the Elgin case from the Supreme Court earlier this year, which tracked a Civil Service Reform Act claim with accompanying constitutional claim had to be brought through the established process, which is to the MSPB, to the Federal Circuit.
It's a channeling issue, not a preclusion issue.
Well, if the constitutional claim is not brought through that channeling process, it cannot be brought independently through district court review.
And what's your best case for that?
That would be Elgin.
Well, Elgin didn't hold that. Elgin said you had to channel in the way that was provided by the statute, but this statute doesn't provide that.
So. Right, so we are outside Elgin on that point in that this is a comprehensive system, remedial system that we submit does not allow for judicial review because of the distinctions that between the CSRA and the Court Personnel Act, that Congress made a decision in consulting with the courts not to extend judicial review of administrative office decisions.
There's nothing in the Act that says if there's no judicial, that you can't bring a suit, right?
There's no express language. That is correct, Your Honor.
So what's your best case for this? Is it Dotson? Is that your best case?
Dotson's the best case because it goes into the greatest detail.
And that's circuit. A Second Circuit.
That's a Second Circuit. So we don't have
I'm wondering why you didn't cite the two D.C. Circuit cases, Spagnuolo, which is an en banc opinion of the court, and Hubbard, which is an opinion joined by Justice Scalia, then Justice Scalia by designation, and two other members of our court. Why aren't those the controlling cases here? Those cases reject the rule in other circuits, and for example, Hubbard says, the rule in this circuit, which has been repeatedly applied, is clearly different. CSRA does not preclude federal employees from seeking equitable relief against agencies for allegedly unconstitutional personnel actions.
Correct. That's a difference with the Second Circuit.
The Second Circuit and Dotson, having carefully noted that we follow a particular practice, this panel should abandon that rule in deference to the Second Circuit.
That isn't our argument, Your Honor.
The argument runs.
Dotson specifically discusses the Administrative Office Court Personnel Act, and that's why we cited that as guidance to distinguish between the Civil Service Reform Act, the Congressional Accountability Act, and the Court Personnel Act that the court is looking at. And the distinctions between those acts are significant. There's not a case directly on point on the Court Personnel Act and whether or not it allows, as Ms. Pollack concedes, it allows the court to hear a constitutional claim. And what the Second Circuit pointed out is that the Court Personnel Act initially provided Civil Service Reform Act remedies to certain administrative office employees. When it was amended, that relief was removed. All court employees were considered accepted service. The Congress removed any ability to go to the MSPB or to the EEOC and put that administrative review power with the director of the administrative office.
Do you think that the Congress has the power to cut off? So imagine that the CSRA did not provide any protection for racial discrimination. Are you saying that Congress could cut off a lawsuit if the AO announced we're not going to hire any black employees, that a CSRA, which only provided for administrative review of other matters, would cut it off?
Your Honor, it didn't do that here. It's specific.
It didn't, but it cut off. But in your view, it's cutting off a different constitutional right, alleged. For purposes of the issue we're at now, which is whether we have judicial review, we have to assume that the plaintiff is right here. She claims a constitutional right's been violated. Your answer is that the CPA doesn't provide for administrative review of that particular constitutional right, and therefore no suit is possible. But imagine in another year, earlier year, more benighted year, the statute had not provided for, I don't know, sexual discrimination. Would somebody who has a constitutional right not to be discriminated in employment on the basis of sex not be able to sue because Congress didn't provide for it?
Your Honor, in this case, as the court's hypothetical, I think that would be a difficult argument for me to say could
it's
not.
It's one you wouldn't make.
It's one I would not make, absolutely.
How do you distinguish that case from this?
Because in this case, and this is one of the reasons we cited Dotson recognizing its Second Circuit, is Dotson, the Second Circuit, went into great detail about how the Court Personnel Act here was structured in consultation with the court system itself. And there was a level of trust that the court system was adequate to basically to self-enforce its own personnel rules. And certainly the court system would not have agreed or implemented a merit recruitment plan that allowed discrimination based on sex or race or any of the protected classes that are specifically enumerated in the Court Personnel Act, even extending to political affiliation. And when the Congressional Accountability Act was passed, Dotson explains that Congress thought about extending the protections under the CAA to the court judicial employees, and in extensive discussions with the court system, found it unnecessary, that it was willing to defer.
But what was unnecessary was because it did provide a set of specified violations that were subject to administrative review.
Correct.
But this one isn't. This is a claimed constitutional violation that isn't.
But Your Honor, the Congressional Accountability Act has a specific provision that provides for judicial review of Office of Compliance administrative determinations. And here the Office of Compliance is the Administrative Office Director. Congress chose not to provide a level of judicial review expressly in the Court Personnel Act, or either by making the AO employees subject to the Civil Service Reform Act or the CAA. And we would submit that was a conscious decision in consultation with the courts. And the Judicial Conference reports on an annual basis. It's certainly possible if the courts were concerned about
I respect the Judicial Conference, but it's not a judicial determination, right? It's an administrative determination by members of the court, but it is not a judicial determination. So it doesn't have any precedential or other value for us during this proceeding.
Correct, Your Honor, except
to sometimes even the courts make mistakes, but only, of course, when acting administratively.
But, Your Honor, that's correct, except that the structure of the CPA and the difference between the Congressional Accountability Act, the CPA, and the CSRA makes clear that Congress chose not.
Does that distinction make it clear enough for purposes of satisfying Webster?
Well, there's two elements to Webster, and the first is the plaintiff has to allege a colorable constitutional claim, and we've gone over.
Well, you think it's so flimsy, it's not colorable?
Or a serious constitutional question, yes.
So now you're on the argument that it's such a frivolous merits claim that jurisdiction is lacking.
And then the second element, the second element of Webster would be that there's a heightened showing that Congress intended not to provide judicial review.
So where's the heightened showing?
The heightened showing is
is simply from it's in here they did this, there they did that, which is sort of everyday legislative action.
Your Honor, but
it's a heightened showing. It's not very high.
Well, Congress felt it was necessary with the CAA to provide expressly for judicial review when it eliminated the normal path, the established path to judicial review of CSRA claims through the Merit Systems Protection Board. When it eliminated the MSPB from review of legislative branch personnel actions, it felt that it had to require, put a provision in allowing for judicial review. When it substituted the administrative office director for the MSPB on Civil Service Reform Act claims such as this, a merit principle, and Judge Jackson did cite the Federal Circuit cases that O'Brien that showed that that's the path you go. Without MSPB review, there's no path to Federal Circuit review unless Congress provides for it. And by not doing that...
Can I ask about that? I don't read the district court's opinion as addressing the argument that we're raising, that we're discussing now. I appreciate it's your fallback, but there's no citation to Dotson, no citation to Spagnola, no citation to any of those cases. That this discussion is all in the context of a theory that Larson only applies if there is also some kind of statutory requirement.
Your Honor, the court did not cite Dotson, but she cited on page 8 of her opinion a district court case here, which we didn't cite because it's a district court case, Hollingsworth versus Duff. And in that...
I'm sorry, which... can you tell me a star page or where...
It's
a footnote, footnote 4, you mean?
No, Your Honor, I have the
PCF
version, page 7 onto 8.
I see.
And Hollingsworth cited Dotson, and in Hollingsworth, it articulated the reasoning that the argument that I'm making here today, that we're making here today, that it is a comprehensive, exclusive remedial scheme that does not allow for judicial review.
But this is all part of not having read Hollingsworth, I didn't sort of get the implied reference, but the next sentence says, right after the discussion of Hollingsworth, it says, thus, defendants did not act outside their statutory authority in establishing areas of consideration. And that is that's the development of the court's argument that Larson only applies if there's a demonstration that defendants were acting outside their statutory authority.
Correct, as individuals and not as a sovereign.
Right, right. So it's not quite the argument that you're making today. I'm not saying you're precluded from making it, but it doesn't appear to be the one that the district court resolved the case on, and maybe that's an argument that you're entitled to make before the district court and the plaintiffs is entitled to respond to before the district court, but doesn't appear to be the one that the district court has rested the decision on.
I agree. I understand, Your Honor. But I think, as I indicated, Judge Jackson sort of resolved in her mind that the actions, personnel actions challenged here were under the established regulations, and there's no indication that the authority that was conferred by the CPA and the merit recruitment plan established under that was exceeded in any way. And she did not address the constitutional claim directly, but I think she did indirectly by suggesting under those circumstances, those facts do not give rise to a legally recognized right or a colorable constitutional claim. You know, my time's exceeded, but, you know, our position is this is essentially a defective equal protection clause claim by the plaintiff. She neither has a federal right to, she doesn't have a fundamental right to federal employment, and she relies on Article 4 jurisprudence on the Privileges and Immunity Clause where there's a fundamental right to seek an occupation or pursue an occupation in another state, but that is Article 4, which applies to the states and not the federal government. Her Equal Protection Clause claim would be she does not have one because there's not a fundamental right to a federal job, and that authority is well established. She's not a member of a recognized...
There's a rational basis, right?
So that, I think she's trying to avoid the rational basis review by claiming that this is an Article 4 Privileges and Immunities Clause where there is case law in the private sector that you have a fundamental right, a resident of any state, to go to another state and seek employment. But that does not apply to a federal job. And the other prong... for heightened review under the Equal Protection Clause, which she'd have to be a member of a protected class, suspect protected class. And a non-resident of the District of Columbia who does not work for the Administrative Office of Courts is not a suspect protected class under the Equal Protection Act clause. So she is left with rational basis review. Here, there's certainly a conceivable set of facts under which the limitations on two of the five jobs that the plaintiff applied for, three of them she was able to be considered for and did not get hired, simply limited the pool of qualified applicants that could apply to anyone nationwide who worked for the court system or D.C. commuting attorneys who worked in the D.C. area commuting.
It doesn't change the constitutional claim that in certain job searches, the AO didn't pursue the allegedly unconstitutional procedure.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there is evidence.
It's constitutional in all procedures, in all hirings.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there is empirical evidence that when the search is when the vacancy is open nationwide to all sources, that it doubles the number of qualified applicants.
One can think of solutions to that.
But under a rational basis, the court does not need to go there.
Yeah, well, it's a rational basis with or without teeth.
But we would submit that that's a conceivable set of facts that provides a rational basis, that in certain announcements, the selecting official has discretion to limit the pool so long as he has a sufficient number of qualified applicants. And whenever you go outside the judicial branch to attorneys in the commuting area, D.C. metropolitan area, you certainly get enough qualified applicants. And so the decision whether or not to go inside or out is fine. And unless the court has any other questions.
All right. Submit. How much time does Ms. Pollack have?
4 minutes.
All right.
Your Honor, as far as rationality goes, first of all, there has been no discovery whatsoever, so empirical evidence is not before this court. Second of all, when the Supreme Court reversed as an administrative matter the Fifth Circuit's incorrect decision in Frazier, which had to do with membership in the bar for one of the district courts in Louisiana being limited to people who, while they practiced in that bar, had an office, did not have an office in Louisiana, nor a residence in Louisiana. The Supreme Court said that that was not just wrong, it was irrational. And this case is worse because here I am perfectly willing to move to D.C. while I work here. I merely mailed the letter with the application from Kentucky. Actually, I sent the email. Do this online. As far as my confusing the claim, I think one should look at the Supreme Court case of United Building and Construction Trades Council versus Camden, New Jersey, from 1984, which I've cited extensively, which said that the job applicants there were down to rational basis on equal protection and therefore lost, did not have a Commerce Clause claim because it was a market participant exception, but nevertheless said that there was a right to travel claim. Furthermore, despite what learned counsel says, he has no basis whatsoever for limiting the Privileges and Immunities Clause to the states. The language of the Privileges and Immunities Clause says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Now, this hasn't had to be litigated against the federal government, is what it really comes down to. There's early case law, I definitely dicta, it was hard to find, but I found it, in two state cases saying that the early judicial view was that this was only against the federal government. James Iredell, during the ratification debates, as we've already mentioned, stated that the Privileges and Immunities Clause was against the federal government. And furthermore, in Crandall versus Nevada, the Supreme Court based the right to interstate movement, specifically the right that I'm asking for to go to D.C., on the structure of the Constitution without any need for any clause whatsoever. Now, I understand that it may be frustrating that this right to travel moves around the Constitution, but that's the Supreme Court's choice. And I'm certainly not going to plead myself out of court by saying it has to be in the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The simple fact is that the AOC has cited no policy basis for its choice, except that it feels like it. It has cited no ratification documents or discussion that would show that it was allowed. It has cited no cases that really say that this right does not hold against the federal government. The only two cases it cites are the Fifth Circuit case, where it was a throwaway line. It was reversed by the Supreme Court, though the Supreme Court chose not to reach the Constitution, as it usually chooses when it can help it. And one thing the AOC has never responded to is if it thinks it's a court, which is the only way it gets out of 702, the 701 exception doesn't say judicial system and all agencies thereof, it says the courts, then it should be bound by the Supreme Court's administrative statements in Frazier that you shouldn't be doing this judicial system. You know, can't have it both ways. The only other case that they've come up with is Matuso versus U.S., which is a Ninth Circuit case, in which the court said without any analysis or authority whatsoever, there is no right to travel against the federal government. But then it instantly went on to say, and even if there was, this guy wouldn't be within it because what he wanted was to change duty stations to Hawaii, the federal job, and still get locality pay, which is not available by statute in Hawaii. I am not asking to be paid more or to be given a leg up in the application process because I live in Kentucky. All I'm asking for is to be not discriminated against when I apply for a federal job because I live in Kentucky. That's hardly the same thing. So the simple fact is, and which is why, as Your Honors made my sovereign immunity argument for me, the simple fact is that the only interesting thing about this case is the merits. For some odd reason, and I presume it's because the federal government understood that this was part of the structure of the government, we've never had to litigate this. And here comes the I apologize, Your Honor. Is my time up? Yes.
Yeah, why don't you wind it up?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. For some reason, the administrative office has chosen to violate a practice that's existed since the founding and claim that it can do it just because it's not irrational, even though the Supreme Court in Frazier said it was. Thank you very much, Your Honors.